What's up, everybody? Thanks for tuning in to Beam Radio.
Welcome back to Beam Radio. I am your ever-present host, Lars Wikman, and with me on the panel today, I have Andrew Ek, or Ek, as he is known in the U.S. Hello, Andrew.
Lars, glad to be here.
And as per usual, we are sponsored by Underjord, my company that does consulting in the Elixir and nerves space. If you have needs in that regard, feel free to reach out. Always happy to have a chat and see if we can help each other. And then, of course, also Groxio or grox.io, which is career fuel for programmers. They make courses about Elixir, about OTP, about all the things. So check them out. Bruce is not here to give a update on what's current, so you'll have to go over there yourself. But we also have a very special guest. And it's a very, very special guest because he is, if not the original, but the at least the current B in Beam Radio, and Beam, B as in the Beam itself. Welcome to the show, Björn Gustafsson.
Oh, thank you. Nice to be here.
Yeah, so to give that a little bit of context, some people might not even know what the Beam, what BEAM as in Beam stands for. So originally Erlang ran on the JAM, Joe's abstract machine. And then it was replaced with Bogdan's Erlang abstract machine. Bogdan does not work at Ericsson and work on OTP anymore, as far as I know. And since many years back, we'll find out how many Björn has been maintaining the Beam. So the letter remains, the person has changed. All right, and the very first question we usually ask, and that's incredibly important here, is how did you get involved with Erlang and the Beam?
Well, it was a random meeting on a bus on the way home, actually.
Good start.
Yeah. So it happened that I worked at Ericsson, not at Erlang. I had heard of Erlang, but I didn't work with it. I worked on something else, a pager system for pagers. It was just before mobile telephone got used everywhere. So that was in 1996, I think, at the beginning. And it happened that one of the people working at the computer science lab was sitting next door. It was located next door to where I worked in Älvsjö. So we happened to take the same bus. We were going in the same direction. And I recognized this guy. So maybe I should back up a little bit. I started to learn the program. That was around 1980. And I started program on a calculator from Texas Instruments, a TI-59. So it has had about 1 kilobyte of memory and a magnetic card read and write, so it could record your programs on magnetic card. So that's how I learned to program. And you had to key optimize the programs, make them small, often to make them fit. So I very early started to try to make my programs smaller and smaller. And it seemed that I was good at doing that, and I liked it.
That's a good head scratcher to do optimization.
Yeah. So there was a users group for the calculator, and I was active there. I was writing articles in the newsletter. That users group later transitioned to Texas Instruments home computer. And there I happened to meet someone called Tony Rogvall. And that was the person I later met on the bus.
Yeah, so that's quite a coincidence tying together your calculator programming into someone who works at the lab next door.
Yeah, so he said that I should start working at the lab and help to develop the runtime system. So he said that I could do great work there. So he talked to some people there, and I met Mike Williams. But he wanted me to help him with the project. So an Erlang project. So I worked on that project for 6 months. And he said that I could quit anytime I want and go to OTP. The OTP team was newly started in 1996. So I did that. At the end of the year, I started at the OTP team. And I think one of the first things I did was Microsoft Windows port to Windows 95. I think I did most of that work. There was an existing port for Windows NT, but it didn't. Windows 95 was a little bit different. So I worked on that. And I think already the next year, 1997, Kenneth Ludin asked me to learn more about the beam and to maintain it. He might have an idea that maybe Bogdan wouldn't stay forever at Ericsson, but he wanted some. And also, Bogdan was at the CS lab, and I was at OTP, so there were different organizations. So he wanted someone in at OTP to be able to maintain Beam. So yeah, so I started looking at Beam, fixing bugs, stabilizing, and so on. The thing. This time, at this time, there was Gem and there was Beam. They shared the source code for the runtime system. So for every OTP release we did, we released it both for Gem and Beam. So it shared the Erlang code, and there were different runtimes compiled, different compilation runtime system. Gem at the time was very stable and used by a lot of customers. Worked well, and didn't use that much memory. Beam used a lot of memory, so the code was much larger. It was optimized to run fast, so it was much faster than Gem, but the code was much larger. So Kenneth wanted me to try to make Beam use less memory and has fewer bugs. So I was working on that.
That's interesting. What was a lot of memory in that day? Let's see. We're talking about like 97, around there?
Yes. It was 32-bit machines, and they had 64 megabytes, but probably a lot. Something like that. Because I remember that the Gem put it on just more than 128 megabyte.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, because I saw a presentation by Frank Hunleth, who built out the Nerves project, on some of the devices they use for their smart thermostats. And they use 32-bit ARM devices. Single core, down clock to 350 megahertz, so it's fairly slow in modern terms. And they, I think, just mostly by convenience, they've ended up at like 256 megs of RAM, because I think their system takes more than 128, but not a lot more. Or that's like, I think they have about 100 megs to spare for that device. And by modern standards, that's kind of lean. Like it's not heavy but
yes, that's lean, more standard.
But built for a different time as well.
So on my work on Beam, there was another problem with Beam at that time. Hotcon loading couldn't really be used because there was a very tight coupling between the LM compiler producing Beam code and the runtime system for Beam. So there was a new version of Beam file for basically for every release, even minor releases. The Beam file format was incompatible. Everything had to be rebuilt from scratch. There was a version number incremented every release, and you can't really do hot code loading that way. So that was also a thing I wanted to do. So one of my major inventions, I think I'm good at improving things. I haven't invented many things, but the Beam loader is one of my inventions. It was my attempt to separate what the compiler did, the LM compiler, and what the runtime system did. I wanted to have a more cleaner abstraction so that the compiler didn't have to know all details about the runtime system and the Beam virtual machine. So I did that, and I made sure the loader could do some optimization, specialization of instructions. So I wrote domain specific language. I invented my own, so it could look at, for example, it could match instructions, two instructions, and combine them in the loader. That used to be done in the LM compiler, but much better to do it in the loader, because then the Beam format could be kept the same. So we could stop updating the Beam format in the Beam files every time. So I wrote that as a Perl script. So to try and translate from that my language to data structures that the Beam loader could use. So that we didn't have to write the Beam loader by hand, which it was done in the beginning. That there was special code for every instruction before that, and there were over 300 instructions.
Yeah, I could see that simplifying things a bit.
Yeah, I think that was, I think it was HTTP R4, the first version of that loader, and that simplification. Yeah. And then, and I think the current Beam format I invented in for OTP R5, and it's still used, the basic format. So the format has the Beam file is as chunks, and every chunk has an identifier of four letters. So for example, there is a code chunk and a chunk for atoms and so on. So at the start, there were five mandatory chunks that was needed in every Beam file. But then it's possible to add other chunks, and the loader could ignore chunks it didn't recognize and so on. But that is still used, current Beam. Mm-hmm. And I also made it possible to make sure that it would be possible to see that, okay, this Beam file is too new. I did that by recording the opcode for highest instruction used in that file was recorded in the header of a code for the code chunk. And if it was too high, the loader will refuse to load it.
Right, because the system can be running an old version of the Beam, and the language and the compiler has moved forward and invented new things.
Yeah, from that point, we always been able to run at least two older releases from older releases. So that makes it possible to do hot code loading.
There's a lot to it. So you work day to day with the Beam and a bit with the compiler. Is that about right?
Yes.
Yeah. What is that work like day to day? Like, what do you spend your time doing?
Interesting questions. Well, there are different parts. There could be bug fixes that come in bug reports. There could be new features. Could be helping others because I've been working a long time now. Now I spend more time helping others. We have a compiler team. We haven't had that for a long time. I was the compiler team. Thanks, basically until UTP 20. Then John Högberg started. Now we have four people in the compiler team. So there also Isabel and Kiko started.
Oh yeah, we've had Kiko on the show.
Okay,
He he's he's is he still the new guy?
No, I think Isabel is the newest now. I think
Okay, cool.
she started this this spring. So she's working with dialers and the compiler and runtime system. So it's nice to have a real team. So
Yeah.
now I spent time trying to help others get productive.
Yeah, I imagine you have a lot of built-up experience. So you
Yes.
started with this about 96, 97.
Yes,
So
we
that.
are Erlang in 96 and with Beam in 97, I think it was. Yes, yeah.
So about 27 years or so.
Yes.
That is wild. You have more experience doing just the Beam than I have in software development at this point, I think.
Okay, yeah.
So with I think I'm going to let on that I'm a little bit out of my depth technically. I'm very happy to compile code, but I've not spent any time thinking about how it gets compiled or what actually happens on the machine when it runs. But I'm thinking about, when I write line of business feature software, I can tell that it's, directionally correct by showing it to stakeholders, by watching users interact with it, by checking it against specs. And if I get it wrong, I can pretty easily roll those things back. When you're working on the Beam, when you're working on the compiler, when you're working on these core things that with a much bigger surface area of impact, how do you all know when you have it right? How do you know when something is ready? How do you know when the improvement that you are making is the actual improvement? How do you check for, I assume, thousands and thousands and thousands of variations in how exactly the Beam is running in a given environment with a given set of instructions? I'm so curious about how you handle that complexity and also just the margin of error, perhaps.
Okay, I can tell you one thing that we didn't have initially in Beam. It's a pass called Beam Validator, and it happened that we have a bug, a crash in the runtime system. It crashed sometimes, so it could sort of be repeated, and we could get code dumps. So there was one of my colleagues that spent 2 weeks in the debug GDB and trying to find when it happens, and it turned out to be a bug in the compiler, and I was the compiler guy, the only one, so that was embarrassing. So the compiler submitted code that reference a register, a Beam register, that was not properly initialized. It contained random value garbage. After that, I think this must not happen again. I started to write that beam validator pass that would run at the end of each complaint before generating the actual beam file. It would go through and check that all exercises used was initialized. And yeah, everything was as it should. Because the state that entering a function is known, you know from the number of arguments how many register are valid, X register, arguments are in X register. So the beam validator can keep track of that. And if you do an operation, it could make some more register valid or invalidate. So you can keep track of the state. So it's fairly straightforward to do that. And that helped to find bugs. It was a long time ago. I think it was after R11 or something like that.
Yeah. A while back.
Yeah, so we have that. And it can be annoying at times. You think you have written a very good optimization in the compiler, and then you notice that, okay, this code is not valid. Something is not right. But it prevents those kind of bugs coming out. So that has been very helpful. Also, it's allowed to do more stuff in the compiler. For the compiler, also, we run passing, creating random Allen code. Proper for property testing that, which also contains a module for generating random Allen code. It was written by one member of OTP. It's not working for so long, but Hans Bolinder. He's also done XREF and DOST, QLC. He just done a lot of good things. But he also wrote that for generating random Allen code. And lately there was one guy from WhatsApp, Robin Morissette, he wrote a fuzzer. He wrote it in Rust. I didn't know what he was doing first, but he started to send in bug reports for strange Erlang code. It's where no one would write that, but it crashed the compiler or crashed the runtime system. So I soon realized he had some falser there. So and eventually he open sourced it. So now everyone can run. And that has also been very helpful. He found a lot of bugs and also a lot of bugs in the documentation. Things that are not properly documented or not. It could be wrongly documented or not enough information. It was under documented. So you found such things. So I think that's for the compiler. Also, yeah, we try to write tests. We try to be evil and write tests. Write things that would cause trouble for the runtime system or the compiler. And for every bug, we always take that bug report, add it to a test tree. So the test trees are grown by adding things that didn't work. We always add it to the test tree. So we have a lot of strange coding.
A lot of regression tests, yeah.
Yes.
So there's a fairly big test suite then, I guess, for the compiler, plus all these sort of automated and fuzzing and property-based types of tests. And then there's additional stuff, I guess, for the beam itself, which is kind of separate from the compiler.
For the beam itself, we use what you call Valgrind. You know about that?
It's a profiler, right?
No. It tries to find unsafe use of memory. If you remember that are not initialized and other using memory after being freed and so on.
Okay.
Yeah. So it will instrument the program and it will run much slower, but it will find bugs. There is also something newer called what is address sanitizer. I think it's included with Clang, the other big C compiler.
Yeah,
we run that. We also have a debug version of the runtime system. So we have an ifdef debug. We add extra code that we do a lot of extra tests. We have a search center also in the debug compiler, but also we do something is not used anymore. We will write some sort of garbage data to it so that it will look like garbage. And if it's unaccessed, it's likely to cause problem and cause a crash. So we do a lot of those things to try to catch bugs as early as possible.
Yeah, I can see how that's quite helpful.
It's not necessary. Yeah.
Yeah, but that level of rigor makes sense given the context. Absolutely makes sense given the context. This is perhaps a silly question. When you are working on the Beam or the Beam compiler, are you mostly or entirely writing in Erlang?
Erlang compiler is written in Erlang. So that is Erlang.
Oh, I thought that was written in C, but I guess the is mostly written in C.
Or... The Beam is written in C, except for the JIT. The JIT parts are written in C++. Otherwise, it's C.
So are there any major developments currently that you find particularly exciting that are coming for the Beam or Erlang or the compiler that you're tracking with interest or excited to work on?
Okay, this is will not be secret anymore. WhatsApp is working on a debugger that support for debugging the runtime system.
I think I heard something about that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm working on the compiler part of that. If you stop at the breakpoint, you want to examine variables. So you need to know which variables are in which Beam registers. So I'm doing the compiler part of that.
Oh, yeah, that does sound interesting. It seems like there's a lot of interesting exchange between WhatsApp and like the Erlang and OTP team in the last, it might have gone on for a long time as far as I know, but in the last few years, it feels like I hear a lot about exchange there. And I guess they've been running a lot of sort of patched Erlang and OTP stuff, and they're going more and more vanilla as they help sort of integrate their learnings into the open source one.
They give us ideas. We don't take all of the patches and suggest them, but if they have an idea that could be useful for others, we might try to implement it ourselves in a way that we think it's good.
Some of their challenges are certainly their challenges, and I imagine their solutions might not apply to everyone. So it makes sense to be a little bit selective, but it's been very interesting to see what comes out of there. And anytime I talk to Mihao Muscala, there's wild stuff going on over there. Custom, I think they run custom distribution, they have a lot of nodes. They have a lot of nodes in their Erlang cluster. I'm curious, since both Andrew and I mostly do Elixir, how has your experience been with Elixir coming along and sort of using what you and the Erlang and OTP team have built?
I use Elixir about once a year. There's the advent of code. We heard about that.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
So I started in 2018 to, because José Valim had some videos showing how you can solve some of the puzzles in Elixir. He took some old puzzles and showed how to do it. And that sounds interesting. So I started to doing that in 2018. And I continue to do it. Every year I think, I don't have time to do this. I will not. And I usually do it anyway. If not the 1st of December, sometimes I wait and then start doing it after Christmas. So I've solved all of them now. There are 9 years. I went back to did the early ones. So I did call it nine years, all of them. when I use Elixir.
I think you might have written more Elixir than I have at that point.
Really?
Maybe not. But it's like going back through them all and doing as well. That's brave. All right.
And the hard part is not Elixir. It's the problem. The problem themselves become hard near the end, near Christmas and. Well, I cheat usually every year a few of them. I cheat a little. I find some hints on the internet how to solve them. I don't take a solution, but I get some hints so that I can get to write some kind of solution for that's all of them. Fair.
Yeah, I think that's fair. So then you've used Elixir a fair bit. How do you like it?
Yeah, I like it. I suppose I use certain parts more than others. So I write having embedded test case. I use test cases. I always write test cases for the are sample problems, sample input and sample answers. I always make a test suite of that. And sometimes I also write documentation that can run tests in the code if I'm doing something particular trick. José showed that in his videos to do that. So I'm using that part. And I suppose some part of the language I'm not using because I'm like very small code or chunks. No. I have been thinking, I have a private website. I've been thinking using Elixir for that, but I haven't done that. Tricky to get into Ecto and what is Phoenix. Haven't got into them yet. Something maybe, but those websites are not active anymore. So yeah. It would just be to learn more about Phoenix.
But that's cool. I'm glad to hear there's some Elixir being hacked on deep in the core of OTP and Beam development. You're at least well aware of how the language works at that point.
Yeah, also, I remember there was one problem I was trying to solve, and it was running too slow. So I looked at the Beam code, and I saw this could be optimized better. And then I did it for the next release.
that's a different way of solving like the speed problems with the advent of code. It's like no, I'm gonna fix the compiler and the runtime.
I couldn't wait a year to solve it. For optimization, and it wasn't enough. But it was interesting to see that I could do better code generation.
With working on a virtual machine sort of day to day, do you look at how other VMs and runtimes work? I get the sense that the Beam is kind of unusual and quite unique, but maybe you spend time looking at like how does JVM do things. I don't remember what the C# runtime is actually called. Is it CL or something? Like how that works? Do you look at those at all, or are you mostly deep in?
I might have looked a little bit at the GVM long time ago, but only looked a little bit, skimmed. Another thing I've done in the past was on that Texas Instruments home computer, which had the slowest basic possible. But it has a very good fourth implementation. Fourth is a thread interpreter, index thread code, and beam has what is called direct thread code. So they are kind of related. So I did a lot of programming fourth on the home computer, and then I also implemented fourth for PC and. Also implementing C for an embedded system to help me debug that embedded system. It's very easy to write a fourth interpreter. So I know quite a lot about fourth. And I also looked at Tickle, if you know about.
Yeah, TCL.
But it should be pronounced Tickle, I think.
Yeah.
So I looked at how that was implemented, and also a little about the Perl's implement. Perl is very hard to read. The Tickle source code is very, very easy to read. Well commented. The Perl source code is not. They usually one comment in each file at the beginning. Usually a quote from Lord of the Rings, but not much more. So that is not easy to follow.
So you're saying that one quote from Lord of the Rings doesn't sort of clarify the whole code for you. Okay.
There was one for the scanner, I think. This is from where all the foul stench come from. I think that was sort of clarification. The scanner for Perl is it's very ad hoc. It's very complicated. It has a simple parser, but the scanner is horrible.
It's not entirely surprising. I wrote Perl at one point, and it's a very finicky language.
Well, yeah, I used it for that domain-specific language I'm talking about, because, well, I knew Perl, and it wasn't practical to use Erlang for that purpose in bootstrapping. It's complicated to do bootstrapping. The same, you would have to commit generated code, so it would be much more complicated and slower.
Yeah.
At that time, it would have been much slower than Perl.
Yeah. If since we have you here, maybe you can pick apart kind of, because I think in the minds of many people just that are just using Erlang or just using Elixir, Erlang, OTP, and the Beam sort of all flow together. But like from hearing various people, including you, talk about it, I know that there are some fairly distinct parts. And I think most people start to eventually grasp, like, okay, there's the compiler and then there's the Beam. But I mean, there are many more parts, and like, what will you say are the major parts that make up the whole shebang?
That part about the Beam.
Yeah.
Originally, Beam was just the part that loaded and executed Beam code. That was a part of the runtime system. The rest of the runtime system does things like the scheduler, garbage collector, built-in functions, and so on, drivers, a lot of other stuff, a lot of code. And that was shared between Yam and Beam in the beginning. But I really realized that nowadays Beam is the name for the runtime. So I think that's okay, and it doesn't really matter. Yeah. But there was that distinction to begin with. So Beam is the, well, nowadays the runtime system.
So was that what ERTS was all about, like the shareable parts, or like the, because ERTS is Erlang runtime system, right?
Erlang runtime system. So So that is called that, and the runtime system source was separate from Beam and the Jam source in the beginning.
But now it's kind of tied to the Beam.
Now it ties, Okay. So there was a kind of abstraction, so that it was possible to compile both Jam and Beam, but that abstraction long gone.
And how does the OTP fit in?
Let's see. I think the OTP and the Erlang standard library, they are mixed up. It's not really possible to separate what is Erlang, the library for Erlang, what is OTP. So they have also become mixed up.
Yeah, that's also what I've been hearing people at this point, like OTP is just a name for the Erlang standard library, essentially. But I guess Erlang, the language as a language, is kind of separate from OTP. Or I guess like spawning processes and sending messages is more part of the Erlang language. And then there's like a lot of the OTP stuff and a lot of standard library stuff that is kind of separate from the language itself. Is that fair?
Yeah, yes. The built-in functions are part of the language, and they are mostly in the Erlang module, but now we can have built-in functions implemented in C in other modules. So the ETS module, for example, have built-in functions that are implemented in runtime system, but that call through the ETS module. Also the list module has some built-in functions.
Hard lines to draw at this point.
Yeah, I think so.
I guess the people that are building out Atom VM get to have a lot of fun figuring out what lines to draw.
Yeah, I think so. Paul Guyot, I think. I'm not sure about his last name.
I think it's Guyot. It's very French.
Guyot, probably. Yeah. I talked with him. Interesting. I'm impressed in how little memory they can run their stuff.
We're almost back to the calculator, right? How much memory did you have on your calculator?
One kilobyte.
He needed like 400K.
So he needed a bit, 400 stuff. But still, I still find that very impressive.
Yeah, it is. And also, if they're willing to bloat both the space and the memory usage, they can bring in more and more of the existing parts of Erlang. But when they want to stay lean, they sort of re-implement them in a more embedded friendly way. Yeah, it's an interesting project. But maybe not exactly the same guarantees as the Beam itself. No. It's a little bit younger also. As a project, but very cool. I'm dying to try to get some of those folks to get on the show. They've agreed to at some point, but okay. I don't know when. So you've been working on the Beam for a long time. What are kind of the bigger milestones that you feel like the project has hit, specifically maybe around the VM and the compiler, but also anything major that you think perhaps cuts across all of it?
One milestone was in OTP R7. There was a new compiler written by Robert Garding and by myself. He wrote the core Erlang part. We introduced core Erlang at that point, and he wrote that part, and wrote other parts near the Beam machine. And that release also introduced the bit syntax. something that and I think that was the first real open source release. There was one earlier, I think, based on R4 or something, but then there were no open source releases. But from R7, none, there has been open source releases for every release. And then OTPR 11, that was MP runtime series, the multi-thread runtime series, that was the first one.
Oh, yeah, that would be a big one.
That was a big one. But that was mostly Rickard Gren working on that for a year. He did most of the work, but really helped with small things. But he wrote a lot of things to pass in extra arguments to have locks, introduce locks. So it was. I'm not sure how much faster it was. It was probably slower in some instances because there was, for all drivers, there was a big lock for all IO to access any driver. Mm. There was a big lock that had to be taken. And so there was no concurrency there. And then for in the common releases, there were the locks were made more granular. They actually may make it concurrent for concurrent IO.
Yeah.
And then I have one more I remember, UTPR 15. I implemented line numbers in exception. There were no line numbers, so it could be tricky to know if you got a stack back trace. But if there was a large function, it could be difficult to know which part. So I introduced that.
Yeah, that's a lovely, very helpful thing to have. So I'm very glad that exists. I suppose there's a re-implementation of that in the Elixir compiler, where it passes along the same information.
Yeah, it's possible.
And then I suppose we also have the JIT, which is a fairly recent thing.
We also have the we have implementation of new intermediate formats in the compiler. It's a SSA format. It's a static single assignment, I think it's called. Well, it's using LLVM and other compilers. So there's a new way to represent LLM programs within the compiler, and which is more optimizer friendly. Mm. Because it happened in I think it's OTP 21, that we wanted to do more optimizations for BitStreams. And John worked on that. He wrote optimizations based on optimizing beam code. And he spent a lot of time, but it was impossible to do any significant optimization. And then we realized we must do it in another way. So we stop optimizing the beam code. We must do optimization before the beam code, after core LLM, but before beam. So we have a new internal format introduced in OTP 22. So I and John, we implemented this. So I implemented I got it running, and John implemented bit syntax optimization. Some other policy also improved the type analysis part, so we could do much better optimizations. So that was introduced in 22.
So does that mean you're using some LLVM optimization tooling at that stage?
No. We were just inspired by that, and that is cool. It is described in compiler textbooks. So now it's a standard way to do it. So just inspiration. Hmm. And then it turned out that we could, doing the type analysis, we could figure out a lot of types, but we couldn't really do that much optimization on beam code. So that was a little bit irritating. But then with the JIT, which we introduced in 24, we could actually take advantage of all the type information. So in OTP 25, we started to have the ALA compiler emit information about the types into the beam files. And then the JIT could look at it, and the JIT could do more. It could see, for example, if a term is supposed to be a tuple, but it knows it's a tuple of any size, it doesn't need to emit a test for a tuple. It could just extract the element. And also, if you know some information of size, it could emit some other tests. And also doing arithmetic. So if you have range, if you know about ranges of integers, we can omit a lot of tests that if you know that it can't overflow, and that we can emit a lot. We don't have to add code to handle the big integers. Usually we have to be prepared for that. Mm-hmm. So that was introduced in OTP 25, 26, 20. We gradually added more information about types and make the JIT smarter to take advantage of it.
Yeah, the JIT, I remember when it arrived, and it was that was a lot of gain for no particular work for a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I think it was RabbitMQ that in some of their benchmarks saw like a 30% improvement in the best case, and just like pretty much zero downside. So
yeah,
that's significant. All right, I think we are coming up on time, so we need to wrap this up. Are there any people you want to give credit to or shout outs to that haven't received any? And if people want to follow your work, is there anywhere they can go to read more about what you do?
I sometimes write blog posts, so a few every year. So blog.dalang.org is a good place if you want to know more about everything beam and other stuff. And also I am at the Erlang forums. I'm not at social media any longer, but you can find me at the Erlang forums.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. It was very nice to hear more about the beam.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Oh, yeah. Our pleasure. All right, thank you, Andrew. We will wrap this up and thank our sponsors, Groxio, Career Fuel for Programmers, and Underjord. Occasionally I use the slogan mostly functional programming, which I think is clever. Unfortunately, it's not just me that finds that clever, so other people have used similar things. It's very unfortunate. I need a better slogan. I'll work on it. But until next time, this is Bye from Beam Radio.